Welcome to After Hours, conversations for music educators, presented by Amro Music. This is where we share ideas and work towards solutions to better serve your students. This week, Nick Averwater continues his conversation with author and educator Scott Lang about the fourth version of the State of Music Education Survey. The survey started in 2020 as a result of the pandemic, and version 5 is expected later in 2023. Version 4 is broken up into 6 categories, and last week, Nick and Scott talked about 3 of those: instructional time, student learning, and enrollment. This week, they'll be talking about budget, administrative support, and state of mind. Our conversation is broken up into 2 episodes, and this is part 2.
One of the things that you all touched on as well is the budget component, and that's so significant. What all did you learn in the survey as it relates to budget?
This is not a year-over-year budget. The 3 things that were new is we asked about supervision and oversight, administrative support, and budgeting. Those were the 3 new areas for this year. And the budget, I think we all saw this train wreck coming. I mean, no one was under the impression it was going to be, you know, just people, you know, spending Bitcoin out there. But what was really striking to me about the budget were a couple factors. Number one is that most schools did not have a formal process for budgeting or depreciation. They just didn't have anything. Zero. Nothing. That was surprising to me. The second thing that jumped out at me is that, and I don't want to make up a number, though I'm really good at it, is that it was something like 92% didn't have a multi-year financial plan. Like, okay, I'm going to do drumline this year, and I'm going to do sousaphones next year, and I'm going to do choral risers and grand piano. There was basically no formalized process for financing the program. You know, we all knew that the numbers wouldn't be what we wanted, but the fact there was not even a process in place was not disappointing, because we're not trained in this profession and it's not our area of expertise, but it was an area of need and an area of opportunity. And actually, we're coming out today with a new tool for that. But that surprised me. The other thing, when I looked at this, is that when you look at the costs associated with running a music program, and you look at the budget that was provided by schools, that an average instrument replacement budget of $9 for elementary school, $23 for middle school, and $24 for high school for budget replacement, instrument replacement. And when you combine that with instrument repair budgets, that music is financially unsustainable without the parents. And that has to beg the question, why? You know, if I walked into my principal and said, I find it professionally irresponsible for you to offer something at a substandard level, what would their answer be? Do we offer science but not supply microphones or microscopes? Do we offer PE but have no equipment unless parents donate the balls? Do we offer English but no textbooks unless parents chip in to buy them? I find it, frankly, now, if you're talking extracurricular versus curricular, outside of school ensembles, musicals, marching band, whatever, that show choir, that's a different conversation. But I find it, frankly, unprofessional and irresponsible to offer a curricula, but fund it in a substandard way. And my question is, do it or get off the pot. Do music right or shut it down. But stop doing it half, you know what. Stop it. Shut it down. Now, this is a music education advocate telling you, shut it down. That this, we're just going to make you skate a lot, is not okay with me anymore. Because we all know what happened. They'd say, well, then we can't afford it. We'll shut it down. Go for it. I'll be at your next board meeting, because that is going to be a train wreck. I'll be at your next parent conference night. That's going to be a fun night for me. I'll bring the popcorn and watch you get eaten alive. But we're always so darn accommodating. You know, an example, when I was up for new uniforms, years ago, program had grown. We need new uniforms. And a particularly cantankerous board member said, well, we'll just buy 150. And I was requesting 250. Other programs have caps. I said, absolutely. No problem. I want you to meet with the 100 kids I tell can't be in band. And by the way, You have to come up with a criteria to choose them. Ooh, watch out for Title IX. I'd be careful about access, equity, and neutrality. I would really worry about age and opportunity, future. Just tell me what 100 kids, and I'll get you their contact info. Oh, he backed down real quick, and we got the 250 uniforms. You know, we've got to, there's a cost of running a program. And, you know, I for anyone who doesn't read my blog, which is everyone but my golden retriever and my mother, I did a huge piece on this last week of what is the value proposition of music? Well, we know what the cost is. I know what a teacher costs. I know what instruments cost. I know what the building costs. I know what air conditioning. I know what my HR costs. I know what my, I know all that. But what's the value? What's the value of fewer kids vaping? What's the lifetime value of fewer kids getting cancer? What's the value of fewer kids needing remediation offerings? What's the value of fewer truancies? What's the value associated with fewer kids entering rehab? By the way, music kids are less likely to be involved in drugs. What's the value of future teen pregnancies? What's the value of higher GPAs? What's the value of teacher retention? Because you've got happy, fun kids in your classes every day. What's the value of fewer security guards required? What's the value of your deans being able to not do discipline all day? What's the, I mean, we know what the costs are, but how do we calculate the cost benefit analysis? Because those are real calculable costs. What's the value? We know that music is involved in better health, better cognition, better. What's the value of a dementia-free day? What's the value of a lower health insurance premium? That's the value proposition of music that nobody talks about. We all talk about what the cost is. But every time an administrator, a school board member, community member says, I want my schools to be better. Well, it ain't free. Fund your music program. It's not that hard.
Yeah. And there's two, I think there's two parts to this because you're 100% right. And, you know, the things that you just ripped through, I think, are A, so important. And for any of our listeners that may not be familiar with these statistics, there's a lot of really good data. I know, Scott, you have some on your advocacy materials on your website for Be Part of the Music, which is a great resource. Also, I'd encourage people to go follow Dr. Anita Collins over in Australia with Bigger, Better Brains. I mean, she's doing some awesome work there as it relates to the impact of music. But so I think you're unpacking really that there's an advocacy need here, right, in that we have to be able to articulate better the value of music and the funding will follow. You know, I think the other thing too, which you kind of touched on, is the language that we use to communicate our needs, right? We don't have a five-year plan in place. We don't talk about maintenance cost and repair cost. But that's what school boards hear all day. I mean, they hear about the life cycle and the annual maintenance cost of air conditioners, cafeteria equipment, school buses, computers. I mean, they know if they buy a school bus that they've got, it's going to last 10 years in their fleet and they need to put $30,000, I don't know, I'm making this up, X number of dollars per year in maintenance to maintain that instrument, or excuse me, that school bus. I think there's an opportunity to be sure we're using a common language here.
So it's a great point, and it's actually going live, I think, today. It's done. We have a tool for that. And it was just an area of opportunity for us because as ESSER began to fade away, we had built what started as a Google Doc. But when most people were done with ESSER, we actually codified it into a piece of software, and it's called a funding request generator. And so what we did is we tweaked it just a little bit and made it less about ESSER and more about program funding and generating 1 year, 3 year, 5 year funding requests. And that's going live on the dashboard today. So that funding request generator, and it's important for two reasons. Number one, because it'll be an incredible time saver and energy saver and frustration saver, because in a mere 7 to 8 minutes, you can answer a ton of questions and come out with a budget request, a codified, justified budget request. But the second part is it'll get you to think about things you hadn't thought about. You know, when I went back and revisited it to repurpose it, I was like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. Oh, I didn't think about not just stands, but stand racks. Oh, I didn't think about private lessons and codifying that into my budget. So it really is something that will not only save every director time and frustration, but when you're done, will produce you with an incredibly detailed and professional report that you can share with decision makers that will show you have a 1, 3, 5 year plan. And we've got plans to evolve it even further as a part of our 2023 roadmap so that it becomes an incredibly polished, not only budgeting tool, but advocacy tool. So yeah, the trumpet's got its $59 or $599. And yes, it's got a depreciation schedule of 8 years. But here's what that trumpet means to your GPA. And that's what we're working on right now, is the next evolution of tying numbers to people, to kids.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I think the budgeting, I mean, you and I could do an entire another podcast on this, but and this is something I think a lot of experienced educators learn, quite frankly, the hard way, right? They have to learn how to communicate their needs in the, but this is the way school boards are already talking. Like, they're already doing budgets and they're already doing financial plans, hopefully, for their school districts of the things they need. And I'll share a little success story. Some of our listeners may have heard this, but when I was on the road, I was calling on this little school up in Arkansas, and one night I got a call from a brand new band director. It was like 9 p.m. His name was Hunter, great educator, good friend of mine now. And he was so excited. He said, "Nick, I got the money." I said, "Hunter, I don't know what you're talking about, man." He had gone into his school board. He had been teaching for like 2 months, gone into his school board and cast a 5-year vision and said, in year one, these are all the things that we need to do, and this is the direction I want to take the program, and we need in year two and year three. And he cast a 5-year vision and the financial support that he would require to a school board. They gave him like, it was like $250,000 over 5 years. Because he put it in language and laid it out in such a way that the school board said, we're excited about this. And so they could have easily told him no, and you know, but if you don't ask, I know what the answer is going to be, you know.
Here's the thing is, you know, I always say, what'd you been a music teacher? The only difference between me and the president of the United States is he's got bombs. I mean, it's public speaking, it's the ability to write, it's strategic planning, it's financial planning, it's budgeting, it's working with kids, it's working with adults, it's facilities, it's program analysis, it's creative, it's analytic. Like, we're not trained to do all the things we need to do to be successful. We weren't trained to be financial analysts. I wasn't trained. I mean, I had to come to you to learn how to do a pivot table. No one ever trained me how to do that. I don't have a business degree. No one taught me about marketing and social media. That the demands on a music teacher's day and the demands on their skill sets are just so far and wide that every tool that we can give them, every tool, whether it's pedagogical in nature or program in nature, that allow them to focus on what they need to be doing to best serve their students is something that we are actively pursuing. We always say, let us do what we do best so you can do what you do best, teach.
Absolutely. Well, Scott, and kind of continuing this, we talked about funding, and this, of course, is, you know, dollar spending per pupil is how you all broke it down. Let's talk about administrative support, because you asked some new questions about fine arts coordinators and supervisors, and tell me about some of the things that you all learned in that.
Yeah, that's a pretty interesting and easy takeaway. 65% of America's teachers have no oversight, period. They have no fine arts coordinator, and they have no department chair. They have no team lead. They've got nothing. 65% of America's teachers are unsupervised. And it's not about supervision. 65% of America's teachers have no advocate. They have no one helping them fight the fight. No one who's looking over their shoulder saying, "You're killing it, dude. Hey, let me help you get that Barry Sachs." 65% of America's teachers are alone. Alone. And in a world where it's all electronic and all you see is Facebook, how great everyone else is doing, that isolation is a career killer. So that was the first thing that I knew the fine arts coordinator number was going to be lower. I did. But I didn't. I thought the department chair number was going to be higher. I thought they'd have someone. And that's because I come from suburban high schools where you got those. But you're not alone if you're out there. And then in terms of administrative support, the takeaway is, now this is a statistically valid response. Meh. Meh. Does your administrator like you? meh. It was 49.9 to 51.1. Everyone was on the fence. Eh. Does your administrator like you? 49% yes. 51 said no. Do they support you? 49 said no. 51. It was just a whole bunch of meh. But what was interesting, there was a number in there that I called that I thought was kind of cute, which was those without any oversight average, those without a department chair, I think it was, averaged more money per student than those without. Those without a fine arts coordinator. Those without a fine arts coordinator. Those with a fine arts coordinator got less money than those with a fine arts coordinator. And I thought, now that's weird. And then I went, oh my God, it's the grandpa effect. Can I have candy for dinner? Does your mom let you have candy? Absolutely. Sure, you can have candy. That the principal doesn't know what to do with you. So you need to bury sacks? I don't know what that is, but okay. Where a fine arts coordinator would go, well, no, I can pull it from another school, and your Barry Sachs is 3 years old, and I'll just get it repaired. And like, the fine arts coordinator is mommy and daddy, and you love mommy and daddy, but mommy and daddy say no. Grandma and grandpa never say no, right? They'll say yes to anything. Hey, can I have a llama? Do you need a llama? Yeah, it's part of next year's halftime show. It's critical. Yeah, I can get a llama. I don't care. Like, and so I thought that was a really interesting number, that those with no supervision got more money than those with a fine arts coordinator.
Okay. So they're a little blessing and a curse there, I think.
Yeah, I thought that was really fun. Little trivia, but you got to find ways to entertain yourself when looking at pivot tables.
Yeah. But one of the takeaways, though, for me is that, I mean, the sizable majority of the music educators out there do not have this oversight. And probably the ones that make me the most nervous are those young educators. Because the experienced educators are the ones that we see at the MEA shows, and we see them at Region, and they're coming out and they've established those networks. But I think that's a real call to action for the young educators, and even for the experienced educators, that we have to get, a lot of these people don't have those connections. We got to grab them and kind of pull them into this community, or else they find themselves on an island and isolated. And that's not a good technique for retention.
Yeah, everything we know about this interactive world says it's an isolating one. And it's not, that's not music, that's not teaching. That's just a fact about this world that's supposed to be so interactive. It's not. It's isolating.
Yeah. Great information. And then the last one, we'll just spend a few minutes on this, and then I've got some other topics I want to discuss, because it's not every day I get Scott Lang on the podcast.
Well, but I hope you've got lotto numbers, or, you know, next year's Super Bowl winner, Buffalo Bills. You know, I'm open to any of those sorts of things.
There you go. Well, tell us about the educator state of mind. I mean, you all have tracked this year over year. This is not a new question. This is something you've been following. We're getting some trend lines here. What did we learn?
You know, we learned that people are moving away from the middle. And it's not a big move. It's not. I don't want to be clear. But they're just a little bit crankier, or just a little bit happier. You know, that I'm finally out of this. Thank God. Everything's great. Or this is getting old. You know, so we saw a little bit of an uptick, and I'm feeling great about my job and my profession. We also saw a little bit of an uptick of I'm thinking about a change of profession. And so it's moving away from the middle. And that is completely foreseeable and understandable, just to be clear. Like, I look at the pandemic, and let's look at Ukraine for a second. You know, that it was such a shock. It was a unifying force for the world. The pandemic was. Whatever we have to do for kids, we get it done. You need me in front of a computer, I'll do it. You need me to, you know, show up on Saturday, I'll do it. You need me to wear a mask, I'll do it. We got to rehearse outside in the rain, I'll do it. Whatever it takes. Well, 3 years removed, the shine off that rose is a little bit different. You know, and again, I'm not trying for it to be political, but all reports are, that's the strategy for Putin, is it's a war of attrition. If I just do this long enough, people will get so sick and tired of it, they'll just give up. And so, you know, I think that what we're seeing in the teacher response rate is that there's just a little bit of fatigue in there. A little bit of pandemic fatigue is what I would call it. And And so, but it, again, it was not a huge move, but just a little more crankiness. And to be clear, the crankiest group, middle school teachers, they had a significantly higher rate of negative responses. But then, just for giggles, I went back and I looked at all four surveys. They were the leading negative voice in all four surveys. So I think we all know why. I've got a middle schooler and I'm crankier now than I was before he was in middle school. So I get it. Don't, no judgment here.
Well, and I guess this is to a certain degree encouraging, right? In that things are not getting worse, right? But we don't have to look far to know that there are tremendous opportunities for improvement as it relates to this. Because as we talked about, you named all those things earlier, the impact of teachers is so significant. So I'm glad to hear it's not getting worse, but a little disappointed to hear that it's also not getting better either.
Yeah, but here's why I think. I think it's because we didn't clearly communicate the aftershock. So, when I was talking to directors, I was doing the math. This month or two ago, I was on the road. And they're like, man, it's not back, and it's not what I thought it'd be. And then I looked at them, I said, oh, here's the problem. It's going to be worse next year. And they were like, what do you mean? I go, right now, you got two classes that weren't impacted by the pandemic, two classes that were. You have two engines and two cabooses. They're like, yeah. I go, next year it's one engine and three cabooses. Like, and that's okay. You asked me earlier what my takeaway from the learning loss was. And here was the takeaway I forgot to say. Choose happy. So I when I left teaching, I went to administration. I knew instantly I made a bad choice for my life. And when I went back to teaching, I went to a new school and they were on a block schedule. And I tried to teach the way I did on a non-block schedule. And I was frustrated all the time because I had not as many rehearsal minutes. If a kid was absent, they meant they was gone the 3 days that week. If we had a pep assembly, I'd lost 42% of my instructional. At the end of the year, I realized I was frustrated because I was an idiot. The kids don't care if we drop from grade 5.5 music to grade 5. I changed the wind ensemble to a symphonic band, two on a part. So if a kid's missing, oh well, it's covered. I realized that small adjustments on my end would allow me and the kids to be happier. Listen, I talked about just before we turned the microphones on, space and grace. That the pandemic gave us space away from this to be objective and recalibrate music. And when we came back, it gave us the grace to not have an impossible standard of excellence. We must get a superior UIL. I must place 14 kids in all state. That the pandemic reset all of that. It recalibrated it. Space and grace. And when I'll take ownership. I'm not communicating, hey folks, so let me just say it right now. You need to give yourself space and grace for another 3 to 5 years, depending where you teach, what level you teach, and what you teach. You need to continue to give yourself space and grace. And when it comes, this is Scott Lang's personal perspective. If it ever becomes a position where you have to choose between excellence and joy, choose joy. Nobody remembers excellence. I don't remember what grade level of the music I played in high school. I'm a music educator. I made my life out of this. I have no idea whether it's grade 2 or grade 7. I have no freaking clue. No one ever comes back to me and says, oh, Mr. Lang, the Hindemith Symphony, the demand level changed my life. Never. If I've always said, and I'm a survivor as a parent, I won't get into specifics. I'm a survivor. And I mean that word carefully, survivor of bad teaching. My children had some horrific teachers. They've had some amazing teachers. And I'll tell you what, a happy teacher is a better teacher. And if you have to choose between passion and pedagogy, I'll take passion every time. Every single time. Because that's what I remember from music. Passion and joy. I don't remember the pedagogy. I don't remember when I was supposed to use the bis fingering versus the regular B flat fingering. I don't remember the pedagogical impact of traditional grip versus match grip. I don't remember any of that. So space and grace for another 3 to 5 years, you're not expected to have the pre-pandemic level achievement till you have the pre-pandemic level of resources and kids and skills, and it ain't there. Space and grace for 3 to 5 more years, and if you are ever in a position in which you have to choose between excellence in demand and joy for a child or for yourself as a teacher, choose joy. Because as a parent, even as a music educator parent, I'm not interested in your pedagogy. I'm interested in your passion.
Yeah, it's such a great perspective, because I do, you know, I feel myself kind of drifting back to the pre-pandemic ways. And to a certain degree, that's okay, right? And I'm not fighting some things, but there were some lessons. I mean, I would hate for us to go through this experience and not learn anything, right? And to simply go back to exactly the way we are and not remember the things, the good parts we did learn in this experience.
Yeah, you know, and I share your slipping. I've been looking at myself, and I'm slipping into some pre-pandemic bad habits of associated with how I spend my day and the time I utilize. I'm working more than I really think I should, and I'm spending more hours in front of a computer and late nights and weekends doing work when, you know, that was a lesson learned. And, you know, one of the things I've been thinking about is I realized that I was getting everything done that I needed to get done, but I wasn't getting done the things I should get done. And that has to do with impact. That I was getting everything done that other people needed me to get done, but I wasn't doing the things I wanted to do, because the things I want to do for me create impact. They don't check a box. They don't complete a task. They don't fulfill a request. They impact something or someone. And so, you know, the last couple of weeks, I've just decided to stop and step back and go, let's stop this pathway now before it gets worse. Let's realize that you're returning to a place you don't want to return to. And you want to take a lesson away from the pandemic, and you want to find a gain from all that pain. And I think it kind of goes back to the grace and space, you know, to look at your life and make sure that as a teacher, as an educator, as a human being, you don't return to pre-pandemic levels, that you take the best that you can from it and make it not the same as pre-pandemic, better than pre-pandemic. And so that's we're just far enough away from the pandemic to almost not remember it and slip back into those habits. And I'm guilty of it. And I encourage everyone to stop and pause and take the best, forget all the rest.
Yeah. Yeah. And it might be a good time. You know, I'm a big reader, and there's some books that come to mind that I read before the pandemic. You know, of course, Seven Habits is great. And I'm thinking through the quadrants. You know, you're talking about busyness and impact and everything. Great book. I know we've talked about it on this podcast. You know, Carrie Newhoff has one called At Your Best. But it's probably time to reevaluate some of the things that are creeping into our schedule and saying, okay, is this would pandemic Nick have tolerated these sorts of things, or is this just another thing to fill my calendar?
You know, and I'll leave you this. This is something I've been noodling on. You ready to noodle for 10 seconds?
Let's noodle.
The compartmentalization of school. I think, and maybe this is just me as a parent, but I've compartmentalized school. I have, and I'm helping in my son's middle school band. And I was talking to the band director, who is just a fantastic educator. Love working with him. And he was talking to me. He goes, the kids aren't practicing at home. And I said, listen, I dropped the kid off at 8:30. He comes home at 4:30 after the bus drops him off. School's done. School's got to happen at school. You know, and they had thinking about this. They had an after-school rehearsal from 4:30 to 5:30. My kid was happy to go. He was like, yeah, I love it. It's great. But at 5:30, school's over. Like, and as a parent, when I look at homework, when I look at added tasks, and I'm happy to have my kids stay late and do all these things. But one of the things my family learned from the pandemic was school ends at school. It can be 12 hours long. I don't care. But I taught, and my wife, to be clear, taught too many lessons at home. I don't want school at home anymore. I'm done with it. And it was interesting because I started looking at other countries. This is going to be a, I know there's going to be a blog soon. It is. I just don't have it done yet. It's in my mind. Finland, the number one performing country in the world, ends school at 1:30 and does not do any homework. School is done at school. And if you want to have an all-day rehearsal for March Band, that's fantastic. But when they come home, it's over. Don't expect that home to go home. And I think that's the new model for school. And it's not just music. You know, I'm seeing much less homework now post-pandemic than I did see pre-pandemic. I'm seeing much less after-school demands than post-pandemic. And I personally think that's a healthy choice, but I think it's something we need to be aware of and see. And as a teacher, here's the thing. I can fight it or I can fix it. It's your choice. You can be miserable or you can work. So start thinking about after-school sectionals for 30 minutes. Don't do practice records. Those days I think are done. I really do. A teacher emailed, this is how this all came about. Teacher emailed said, I'm so frustrated. I created all these examples of improv. And I checked my Google Drive and only one kid in my jazz band listened to them. And I wrote him a really lengthy email, talked about the compartmentalization. And I said, you can fight this and be miserable, which you are. Or you can just play the freaking recording for 2 minutes in class. Like, what? Don't fight it. You can say it's lowering the standard. I'm going to tell you it's optimizing instruction. Because the way you're doing it isn't working. So don't pretend you're a better teacher. It's optimizing instruction. So I think we're going to start to see a compartmentalization of school to where it is boxed within school. And it's something music teachers and music programs should process through.
Yeah. It'd be really interesting to see how that plays out. Because I can't believe after sitting in a chair all day for 8 hours that coming home and doing 2 to 3 hours of homework is time well spent. But I'm not an educator.
You're either, you know, it's mastery-based learning. So if you know the concept, it's 3 hours of proving you already knew the concept. And if you don't know the concept, it's 3 hours of practicing it wrong.
Yeah.
So if we believe in, you know, truly optimizing our education, we have to meet the students where they are. And one of the things, you know, a stupid little thing I did, every rehearsal, every time I stopped, 30-second practice break, go. Like, because if you're home, I know you're not taking out your horn, so I'm not going to fight you. I'm done fighting because I want this to be not only a joy-filled experience, but I want you to be successful. And so taking the wind ensemble to a concert band, that was the block schedule. Don't fight it. Fix it. Don't fight it. Fix it. But I do think, and I'm not minimizing like kids won't work as hard. They absolutely will. My son, who complains about everything, had no complaints about going to school for an hour and a half after, or going to band for an hour and a half after school. But the minute we got in the car, he wasn't going to go home and practice. He was done with school. Just like you said, I've put up roadblocks. When I'm home, I'm there for my kids. Why do kids not get the same roadblocks?
Great thoughts, Scott. Scott, it's hard to believe we have been having this conversation for over an hour now. I have thoroughly enjoyed it. And I just wanted to say thank you for all the work that you, and I know behind you is a team of people, and Andrew, shout out to Andrew.
Andrew Hernishin. I was going to give him a shout out, so thank you for doing that. He's the wind beneath my wings, Nick. He's the yin to my yang. He's the hot to my cold. He's the polar opposite of me, and he's the guy that makes sure that I don't be part of the music and run it off the rails. And he deserves all the credit we can give him.
Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful person that I get the privilege of working with on some small projects as well. And so Andrew, thank you. Thank you, Scott. Because this data, I think, is so important to track. Like if we don't have this data, then it's going to be really hard for us to act upon it. And if we're going to advance music education, the benefits of music, which I think you and all of our listeners agree is a good thing for us, then we have to measure it, because what gets measured gets done. And so you guys have really taken that on your shoulders and are continuing to track this at a national level. So thank you for all the work that you all are putting in on this.
You're welcome. And look for V5. We're changing the name. At least I think I'm changing the name. It's going to be called the State of Music Education Census. And because what I really want is, just like it's my professional responsibility as a citizen to answer certain questions so that my government can operate, I want every music educator to look at this data point and see it as a professional responsibility, but also a privilege that they get asked. And then in return, they get information and actionable data and analysis. So that'll be coming in October of this year.
Fabulous. Well, Scott, thank you. Always a pleasure, my friend. And best of luck to you and Andrew as you continue this journey.
You as well, my friend.
That's author and educator Scott Lang talking with Nick Averwater about the fourth version of the State of Music Education Survey. You can learn more about Scott at scottlang.net. After Hours, Conversations for Music Educators is presented by Amro Music. The podcast is produced by Nick Averwater and Joel Hurd in Memphis, Tennessee, and you can hear many more conversations at amromusic.com/afterhours.
Hey, if you enjoyed today's episode, here are two easy and fast ways you can support the After Hours show. First, your five-star review means a lot as it helps to boost us in the podcast rankings so that other music educators just like you can find us. Second, if you thought of someone that would enjoy this week's content and episode, hey, please share it with them so that they too can be a part of the After Hours community. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next week.